This is the first in a two-part series entitled Managing Your Mouth. We cannot overemphasize the importance of this topic. Anybody who would like to comment or give us feedbacks on these presentations is welcome to correspond with us at utahkrishnas@gmail.com. We also have a membership PowerPoint and accompanying membership class MP3 for those people who are not physically located in the state of Utah and would like to hear more about the membership program here at the Krishna Temple. Everything that follows is based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks Krishna, what are the symptoms of a God-conscious person? How does he walk? How does he carry himself? What are the things he's interested in? Most importantly, how does he speak? Speech is the most important quality of any man, and he reveals himself for what he is by how he speaks. If you have two well-dressed men standing side by side with valuable threads and fabrics and jewels, you'll not be able to identify which of the two is a fool by looking at how they're dressed. Visually, you cannot tell the difference between the two. But as soon as they open their mouths, you'll immediately know which one is the fool and which one not so. On the other side of the coin, as soon as a Krishna-conscious person opens their mouth, you immediately know that they're representing Krishna. Once Prabhupada was asked, how does one know who's a representative of Krishna? And Prabhupada said, not a very difficult thing. If you have a man who comes to you and he's wearing a suit and tie and a blazer that has a little symbol of IBM in the pocket, and he's got pins from IBM stuck into the coat, and he's got a briefcase that has an IBM logo on it, and inside the briefcase are IBM brochures and marketing tools. And if when he opens his mouth, he speaks about the virtues of IBM products, it's a pretty safe bet that he's not working for Xerox. So similarly, one who talks always about Krishna, who represents Krishna, who identifies himself by his dress, by the dhoti, the kurta, the tilak, the tuft of hair on the back of the head, these are the symptoms of someone who's representing Krishna. And it's to be assumed that if the speech, if the mouth of someone is under control, if the mouth is dedicated to Krishna, just like a woman is married and she's dedicated to her husband. A symptom of a chaste, faithful woman is that she doesn't have a roving eye for other men. She's fixed on her husband. So a chaste, faithful tongue is that tongue which is dedicated to Krishna and does not glorify other less personalities. So the immediate symptom of a Krishna-conscious person is he speaks only of Krishna and matters relating to him. And for such a person whose tongue is under control, in the sense that the tongue is always engaged in Krishna's service, we can assume that the other senses, the sense of taste, the sense of seeing, the sense of smelling, the sense of hearing, and the sense of touching, are also completely under control. Just the example is given of on a tree, if there's to be found one ripe, edible, sweet apple, we can safely assume that there are other apples that have also matured on the same tree. So when the power of speech is purified, when it's faithful to the Supreme Lord and it doesn't rove and it doesn't wag about other topics and other lesser personalities, then it's also safe to assume that the smelling, hearing, tasting, as well as seeing and touching are also purified. Now here's some facts that are interesting. It said the tongue is the most voracious of all the five senses, and it is the most difficult to control. We have 30 conversations daily, which means we spend one-fifth of our life talking. The words that we speak on the average, men speak 20,000 words a day on the average, and women speak 30,000 words a day on the average. The mean average of words spoken by a human being are, during the course of 1 year time, would make up 66 books of 800 pages. Women speak an extra 10,000 words a day. One physiologist tried to explain this by saying the woman, her vocal cords are longer, and so it takes less effort to get them vibrating for a longer period of time. So a man says 20,000 words a day, and often he gets home having expended his 20,000 words at work. And his wife still has 30,000, she still has 10,000 words still to go. Once a guy was asked, "Do you resent the fact that your wife has 10,000 more words a day to say than you do?" He says, "No, I don't resent it, but I'm sure glad when she gets to the last word." A man's tongue reveals him for what he is. Too often we make presumptions based on snap decisions and based on arrogance and self-absorption. One such example is Maharaj Rahugana. He was bitten by the serpent of ignorance and he was cured by the nectarine words of Jad Bharat. Imagine a muddy pond. Oftentimes during the winter, the ponds and reservoirs of water get really muddy and they have a lot of sediment and silt in them. But when the spring rains come, the effect of the spring rains bouncing onto the various reservoirs of water is that the water is clarified and they become crystal clear. So Maharaj Rahugana was a king in ancient days who was extremely puffed up with his opulence, his high birth, and his prestige. He was being carried in a palanquin throughout what is now believed parts of Russia. And one of his palanquin bearers became ill, and so a very stout mendicant from the side of the road, whose name was Jad Bharat, was drafted into the service of the king. He was asked to carry one of the poles of the palanquin. But no sooner had the cavalcade resumed its journey than the king felt he was bouncing. He was being bounced up and down. The cause of the bouncing was this new palanquin bearer named Jad Bharat. Now, the king assumed, because of his dress, his simple dress and his bearing, that this man was a man of inferior station in life. He was a man of inferior intelligence. He attributed the bouncing to some sort of retardation on the part of Jad Bharat. So without listening or without inquiring as to the real reason why the bouncing was taking place, and based on presumptions of superiority, based on bodily station, Maharaj Rahugana began to spew out all these insulting words on Jad Bharat, to just pour invective or verbal vomit, you might say, over his head, calling him useless, retarded, dumb, overweight, fat, moronic, unworthy. But as he went on and on and on with all these insults, he noticed that Jad Bharat stood as if unmoved by the vehement words of the king, by the biting words of the king. Finally, the king ran out of some steam and he said, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" And Jad Bharat retorted, he said, "By your words and the presumptions that are obvious, I see that you're an ignorant person. You're absorbed in selfhood and arrogance, and you've made certain presumptions about me based on my body. But the first symptom of wisdom is that one is not this body. That means to say you're not a king and I'm not a beggar. You're a spirit soul in a king's body. By happenstance of birth, you've got a little bit of a higher standard of living than I do. And I am also a spirit soul inside a body of a spiritual seeker. But we're equal these aren't the words of Jad Bharat, but I'll just give you an example, that in India, the roads are choked with all kinds of conveyances, from Mercedes to hand-pulled rickshaws. And sometimes, being puffed up with false prestige, the owner of the Mercedes will repeatedly lean on his horn and shout out his window, "Hey, rickshaw, 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 get out of the way." There's a presumption there that the man in the Mercedes is more important than the man pulling the rickshaw. The Mercedes car is more expensive, it's a better crafted vehicle, goes faster, has more comforts than the rickshaw, but the man in the Mercedes is not more important than the man in the rickshaw. Even under the laws of the secular government, every human being has equal rights under the law. And as Jad Bharat pointed out the difference between the soul and the body to Maharaj Rahugana, and as he pointed out that Maharaj Rahugana was inflated by false prestige based on a wrong conception of life, because he was identifying with the body, he became puffed up, anxious, and he alienated himself from such a great saint and sage as Jadbara. However, the effect of Jadbarat's words on Maharshi Rahugana were that his polluted conscience became purified, just like the reservoirs of water by the spring rains. And finally, Maharshi Rahugana got down from his palanquin and bowed down at the lotus feet of Jadbarat and accepted him as his spiritual master. So here's a good application of the principle that we've got one mouth and two ears. God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. And the reason is that before we speak, we should listen. If Jadbarat Maharaj had asked, if Rahugana had asked Jadbarat why the palanquin was bouncing, he would have got the answer that Jadbarat, seeing with equal vision, a human being, a learned sage, a dog eater, and even the ants, Jadbarat was trying to avoid stepping on the ants as the palanquin went down the road, and that caused the bouncing. Had Rahugana thought to inquire as to the cause and not presume certain things, and seen Jadbarat stereotypically, he would have found that out in the beginning. But at least to his credit, he was willing to listen to the words of Jadbarat, and thus he became delivered in due course of time. What is open more wrongly at all the wrong times? Open mouth, insert foot. There's a story about a grocery boy in the produce department. A lady came up to him and asked him if he could sell her half a head of lettuce. So the grocery boy went back through the swinging doors to the produce manager, and he didn't know that the lady had followed him back there. And he said to the produce manager, he said, "Do you believe this? There's an old bag out front that wants to buy a half a head of lettuce." Then he turned around, he saw the lady standing behind him and made a quick recovery. And he said, "But this nice lady wants to buy the other half." So he extricated himself from that situation. But there's a saying, those who speak with tact have less to retract. So had the grocery boy spoke with tact in the first place, he wouldn't have had to have scrambled to get himself out of the tight situation that he put himself into. Now, if you want to get a checkup by a doctor for your physical health, to determine the state of your physical health, the first thing the doctor will do is say, stick out your tongue. By the examination of the tongue, the doctor can tell whether you're in good physical health or ill health. Similarly, it's our tongue which determines whether we're in good spiritual health or whether we're in bad spiritual health. The things that we speak about reveal who we are. If we tame our tongue, we've tamed our other senses, and we'll be a credit to our community, a credit to our family, a credit in the workplace, and our speech will be enlightening, enlivening, and educational. If we put trash in, trash will come out. Based on the books we read, the people we hang out with, the food we eat, the movies we see, we're either going to be inputting trash or we're going to be inputting elevating, worthy subject matters. But the point is that whatever you put in, it will come back out. So you put in good, good will come out. You put in trash, trash will come out. Another possible topic for this discourse was, don't let your tongue lick you. Tame your tongue. Don't let your tongue lick you, because it's going to reveal what's inside. Now, oftentimes we'll hear someone say something quite cruel, rude, and insensitive to another person, and then they'll defend themselves or try to deflect attention from themselves by saying, "I don't know why I said that," or "I wasn't serious, I was only kidding," or "Can't you take a joke?" What they're trying to do here is deflect attention from the fact that instead of that statement, that crude and insensitive statement, being atypical, what they're trying to deflect attention from is the fact that that statement is actually all too typical of the state of their heart. When you think uncharitable thoughts about other people, and when you are critical and slanderous in your heart, that will come out sooner or later. And don't try to pretend that that's not like you, or you don't usually say things like that, or you don't know where that came from. I'll tell you exactly where that came from. It came from your heart. And so you cannot get out of that responsibility by just saying, well, that wasn't me, or that was just a slip of the tongue, or I don't know where that came from. We all know very well where that came from. It came from the core of your heart. There are three reasons why we need to control our tongue. Three very, very good and critical reasons. One is, my tongue directs where I will go. Two is, my tongue can destroy what I have. And the third reason is, my tongue displays who I am. The tongue directs where I will go. Here's a picture of two big Clydesdale horses. And yet their direction is dictated by the bits within their mouth. The bit is maybe half an inch wide and possibly 4 or 5 inches long. And that bit determines in which direction they'll go and where they'll end up. Here's another picture of the Queen Mary. It takes 10 miles to begin to turn the Queen Mary. But all that turning comes from a steering wheel in a little cabin somewhere up on the deck of the Queen Mary. You have a 3,000-pound racehorse with a 95-pound jockey on the top of the racehorse, and he's guiding where that racehorse goes and how fast it takes to get there by the reins, by the little bit in the mouth. So the mouth determines where we're going to go in life. Just like the wheel of a ship, or better yet, the rudder of the ship. The Queen Mary's anchor, incidentally, has the weight of 10 cars, and on the deck of the Queen Mary, there are 3 acres of recreational space. And all that is, the direction of all that is determined by something on the back of the ship called the rudder. So, what do you want to be in the future? What do you want to be 20, 30, 40 years from now? You need to tailor your speech in such a way as to get that particular result. If you hang around, if you just hang out with a bunch of deadbeats, go to the movies, change the channels, flick the remote, killing time, you're not going to be in any good place 20 or 30 years from now. But if you want to change your direction, then change the way you talk. Here's a lexicon of words which will elevate one in due course of time. Some samples of words that you need to incorporate into your vocabulary in order to change your direction for the better are knowledge, learning, challenges, responsibility, whole person, trusting, appreciative, potential, behavior, emotions, epiphany, possibilities, developing, journey, beliefs, values, questions, non-judgmental, actualization, visionary, understanding. Now these words are going to take you to a good place. And the most powerful words of all, which will take you to the ultimate place, are any names of God. God has different names according to different cultures: Elohim, Emmanuel, Yahweh, Vishnu, Krishna. Great saints and sages for thousands of years have chanted Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. They've centered their lives around the names of God, the glorification of God in a process called kirtan, and the discussion of God's pastimes and activities as they're described in scriptures like the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Mahabharata, and the Ramayana. And thus dedicating themselves to God-centered topics, after leaving this body, they go to the kingdom of God. So that's a pretty good result based on a change of vocabulary. Another example is Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj experienced a change of heart. He did penances and austerities. As a 5-year-old boy, he was cheated out of his kingdom unfairly. He went to the Himalayas. He was coached by a great sage named Narada Muni. He ended up suspending his breathing, doing yogic pranayama, the result of which is the Supreme Lord appeared before Dhruva Maharaj. And as a 5-year-old boy, Dhruva was tongue-tied and he couldn't get out any appropriate words of glorification. He stuttered and stammered. But then the Lord touched the head of Dhruva Maharaj with his conch shell. And as soon as he was touched in this way by the Lord, from Dhruva's mouth came the most beautiful Sanskrit poetry of all time. And one of those verses, translated in English, is as follows. Dhruva said, "My dear Lord, after entering within me, you have enlivened all my sleeping senses, my hands, legs, ears, touch, sensation, life force, and especially my power of speech." So the first symptom of a spiritually realized person is that the power of speech becomes purified. A man speaks 20,000 words a minute. And when you think about it, Even one or two injudicious, thoughtless words can destroy a marriage. They can lose your job for you. They can destroy a friendship of many, many decades standing. So dangerous is speech when it's not used properly. It can be compared even to a weapon. But when one is spiritually realized, and when one has Krishna within the core of one's heart, and when Krishna literally takes over one's senses, one can speak not only 20,000, but 40,000, 100,000, 300,000, 500,000 words a day. And not only will no one be offended, but the whole world be benefited and blessed by that person. Haridas Thakur is a good example. It is said an average man speaks 20,000 words a day. And there's a good chance that some of those words alienate someone, or some of those words were perceived as rude by another third party. And yet, after being Krishna conscious, Haridas Thakur uttered 300,000 words every day. So he didn't put a guard at his mouth for the 20,000 words. He didn't stop speaking. As a result of his senses having been enlivened and his senses having awakened from their sleeping state and being consecrated to the service of the Lord, and in effect the Lord taking over, the Lord is now taking charge of Dhruva Maharaj. He's taking charge. The Lord doesn't want to be just a resident in our heart. He wants to be the president of our heart. He wants to be our life manager. And if we allow him to do that, we'll never have to worry about speech getting us into trouble. Haridas Thakur said 300,000 words every day. And he's glorified as a great, great saint and sage. In fact, the whole society is redeemed whenever someone like Haridas Thakur takes his birth in amongst them. Silence is not an option. If words, uncontrolled words, get you into trouble, you'll not get out of trouble by trying to be silent. It'll bottle up the emotions and eventually they'll come out anyway. It's like a soda bottle. If you shake it up, even if you don't open the top right away, sooner or later it may come out in a sideways fashion. Sooner or later the pressure will release itself. Once a fellow joined a Trappist monastery, and in this monastery there was a 3-year probation period during which they had to observe a vow of silence, and they could only speak 2 words at the end of each year. So one fellow joined the Trappist monastery, and he observed 1 year's vow of silence. At the end of the year, he went up to the prefect, the head of the monastery, and uttered 2 words. He said, "Bad food." So then the second year passed without any speech, and at the end of the second year, he again presented himself before the prefect and said 2 more words. He said, "Hard bet." And third year passed in silence, and at the end of the third year, which was the end of his probation period, he went to the prefect and he said, "I quit." And the prefect said, "I'm not surprised. You've done nothing but complain ever since you got here." In the Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna, what can repression accomplish? We're given the power of speech. And we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. If we don't know how to use speech properly, the answer is not to repress it, is not to take a vow of silence. But the answer is to purify our speech by speaking exclusively about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The tongue will determine the direction we go. Secondly, the tongue can destroy what you have. The tongue can destroy what you have. In the beginning of creation, there was an imaginary figure of God created called the Virata Purusha. This basically is a gigantic universal manifestation in which one imagines that the trees and the grass all over the planets are the hairs of the Lord, and the mountains are the bones of the Lord, and the sun and the moon are the eyes of the Lord. It's a gigantic universal manifestation. And as this, in the beginning of creation, as this form was being assembled, the element of fire was placed in his mouth. That's very instructive. Agni is the god of fire. And we all have Agni in our mouth. We can create havoc with our mouth, just like a forest fire. In 1983, I don't know if this is the all-time record, but in 1983 in Australia, a fire destroyed 600 square miles of forest. It was voracious and it was uncontrollable. So do you know anyone that has fire in their mouth? Of course, fire can be warming, it can be enlightening, but it can also be out of control, it can be voracious, it can burn, it can roast. Do we know any verbal arsonists? Do we know any people that by their speech cause harm to other people? Do we know other people that by their speech set fires wherever they go? In history, Joe McCarthy, the anti-communist, could have been said to be a verbal arsonist. He destroyed lives, countless lives, by his words. And on TV, every once in a while, there's an advertisement for what Dean Martin recorded as the celebrity roast. Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, Jack Benny, Bob Hope would all get together, and they would insult each other during the course of an evening. And that would be called the celebrity roast. So do you know anyone like that? Do you know anyone who's a verbal arsonist? It's easy to destroy things. It's easy to burn something. You can build a house, and anyone can burn a house down, but how many people can build a house? So there's no credit in being a verbal arsonist. And whenever we gossip, we're also practicing verbal arsony. To speak about a third person who's not present, who cannot defend themselves, to speak about them in their absence in a way that you would not dare to speak to them face to face is a cowardly, arrogant behavior pattern. How many times has a single careless word destroyed a marriage, destroyed a career, a reputation another, a friendship? It is a weapon. It is a weapon. Most serious weapons like fire throwers and nuclear weapons and even bullets are propelled by fire, which is the result of gunpowder being lit. So fire is a weapon. It's a very dangerous weapon when it's used that way. And words are also weapons. Probably in the history of the world, more careers, reputations, and even lives have been lost because of words rather than actual weapons. When they're out of control, they can destroy. Here's a scenario for you, a chain reaction scenario. Husband gets home from work. He's a little tired. He's a little snippety. And he yells at his wife. And his wife says something mean to the oldest daughter. The oldest daughter pinches her kid sister. The kid sister kicks the dog. The dog bites the cat. The cat scratches the baby. And the baby breaks the head off the Barbie doll. Now, wouldn't it be simpler if the husband just came through the door and broke off the Barbie doll's head and skip all those intermediate steps. But then when the husband and wife go to the marriage counselor, they describe the scene as all hell having broken loose. All hell having broken loose. It's like when the husband comes home and he says something snippety, it's like throwing a match in a dry grass. Then the huge conflagration takes place. And we're all revealed by our tongue. As well as establishing our direction in life, as well as containing the potential to destroy what we have, the tongue displays who we are. And we're all, to some degree or other, Dr. Jekylls and Mr. Hydes. One minute, that same tongue may be praising God, singing hymns in the church, and the next minute, it's running someone down who's made in God's image. If we're all made in God's image, then we need to be cutting a little slack. We need to take into consideration that our origins are divine and that we're all parts and parcels of the same Father and just cut a little slack to each other, not speak lovingly to someone one minute and the next minute lash out. Does it bother you that oftentimes we're more polite and more scrupulous about how we talk to strangers than we are about how we talk to our own family members? When we're out in public and talking to strangers, we're very, very guarded, and we actually think before we speak. And ironically or paradoxically, when we're with family members, we often fail to think before we speak. We just react. We become unpredictable. And we make our kids, we make our spouses jumpy and nervous around us because they don't know what's going to come out of your mouth. And you don't know what's going to come out of your mouth because... Whereas with strangers, you give them the courtesy of some a forethought before you speak, you often don't give your own family members, your own loved ones, that same courtesy. It's like in Yellowstone, there are signs all over the place, don't feed the bears. And they're so cute, and they're coming up to the car, and they're begging. And you can feed them maybe 20 times, and nothing will happen. But then the 21st time, all of a sudden, they've got your arm. They've bitten your arm or they've scratched your arm. It's unpredictable. And so someone who hasn't controlled their tongue is unpredictable. No one can trust a person, not their wife, not their children, not their fellow employees at work. Without controlling the tongue, no one can trust that person because you never know when some poison from the depths of their heart is going to come out. Here we see a picture of a snake. There's a saying by Chanaka Pandit, an Indian moralist, that of the two, a snake and a man who has a vicious tongue, the man who has the vicious tongue is the more dangerous. And the reason for this is that the snake can be controlled by mantras and by music. But the man who has a vicious tongue cannot be controlled by any way. And just as the snake can kill, just as a snake can act as a weapon, similarly, words can be deadly poisonous. You know, we talk about character assassination. That's all done verbally. Character assassination, and we can never tell when it will strike. Ultimately, the problem that we're talking about is not a problem of the tongue. Tongue is just a symptom. Tongue reflects what's really going on in the heart. The problem is not the tongue. The problem is a heart problem. It begins in the heart. You'll not get fresh water from a salt spring. You'll not get mangoes from a cactus. Here's a verse from the ancient Rig Veda. In accordance with the general process of creation, speech always becomes audible in three preliminary stages, which proceed from subtle inner impulse, imperceptible vibrations, to the fourth stage of outward expression, which people understand as speech. This verse means that by the time we speak something, it's already gone through three preliminary stages. You cannot stop your speech at the mouth. You need to treat the heart. That's where it begins. From the heart, you get the initial momentum, the initial inner impulse, the initial imperceptible vibrations, and then only at the fourth stage, going outward from the heart, does audible speech come. So you cannot just stuff it. You cannot treat the problem at the mouth. You have to treat it at the heart. And next week, we're going to talk about Lord Chaitanya's process for cleansing the mirror of the heart. Cheto Darpana Marjanam. The heart is like a mirror which has been encrusted with dust since time immemorial. And the process of chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the time-honored and time-tested process for cleansing the dust from the mirror of the heart. When it's done faithfully and repeatedly on a daily basis, gradually the dust becomes removed, 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 and the mirror of the heart begins to reflect a pure, pristine image of the self. The self is eternal, it's full of bliss, it's full of knowledge, it's part and parcel of God. And we're put here to represent God and to represent the eternal spiritual world and canvas for fallen conditioned souls in this world to make their lives perfect in this life and in the next life, go back home, back to Godhead.